from Metamagical Tamos. Questing for the Essence of Mind and Pattern by Douglas R. Hofstadter. Chapter 11. Stuff and Nonsense. December 1982.
Buzz, quoth the blue fly, hum, quoth the bee, buzz and hum they cry, and so do we. In his ear, in his nose, thus, do you see? He ate the dormouse, else it was he.
Ben Jonson. Eh? What does this mean? What is its point? This little nonsense poem, written around 1600, begins with an image of insects, slides into an image of someone's face, and concludes with an uncertain reference to the devourer of a certain rodent. Although it makes little sense, it is still somehow enjoyable. It reminds us of a nursery rhyme. It is comfortable, cute, droll. Nonsense has been around for a long time. Its style and tone have changed over the centuries, however. The path of development of nonsense is interesting to trace. What marks something off as being nonsense? When does nonsense spill over into sense, or vice versa? Where are the borderlines between nonsense and poetry? These are issues to be explored in this column. A century and a half after Jonson wrote his poem, an English actor named Charles Macklin became notorious for boasting that he could memorize any passage on one hearing. To challenge Macklin, his friend the dramatist, Samuel Foote, wrote the following odd passage.
So she went into the garden to cut a cabbage leaf to make an apple pie, and at the same time, a great she-bear coming up the street pops its head into the shop. What? No soap, so he died, and she very imprudently married the barber. And there were present the pickninnies, and the job lilies, and the gerriulies, and the great Panjan Droom himself with the little round button at top. And they all fell to playing the game of catch-as-catch-can till the gunpowder ran out at the heels of their boots.
Full of non-sequiturs and awkward, choppy sentences, this must have been an excellent challenge for Macklin. Unfortunately, we have no record as to how he fared on first hearing it, but we do know that he so enjoyed the passage that he went around reciting it with great gusto for years thereafter. In the 19th century... Dun-dun-dun! The reigning monarchs of nonsense were Lewis Carroll and Edward Lear. Everyone knows Carroll's Jabberwocky, Tweedledum and Tweedledee, and The Walrus and the Carpenter. Most people have heard of Lear's The Owl and the Pussycat. Fewer have heard of Lear's The Pobble Who Has No Toes or The Dong with the Luminous Nose. Carroll and Lear both enjoyed inventing strange words and using them innocently as if they were commonplace. Their nonsense was expressed largely in poems, where they indulged in much alliteration, many internal rhymes, catchy rhythms, and offbeat imagery. Rather than exhibit works of those two authors, I have instead chosen to represent their era, an anonymous poem with some of the same charming qualities. Indifference.
In loopy links the canker crawls, tads twiddle in their polian glee, yet sinks my heart as waterfalls. The loon that laughs, the babe that bawls, the wedding wear, the funeral poles, are neither here nor there to me. Of life, the mingled wine and brine, I sit and sip pip-slipsily.
Many of Carroll's nonsense poems were parodies of popular songs or ditties of his day. Ironically, the parodies are remembered, and the things that triggered them are mostly completely forgotten. Carroll loved to poke fun, in his gentle manner, at the stuffy mores and hypocritical mannerisms of society. One of the characteristics of genteel poetry of the 19th century was its precious use of classical literary allusions. Carroll seldom parodies this quality, but Charles Battell Loomis, a little-known writer, admirably caught the style in this poem, a classic ode.
Oh, limpid stream of Tyrus, now I hear the pulsing wings of Armageddon's host, clear as a Kolkothar, and yet more clear, twin orbs like those of which the Parsees boast, down in thy pebble deeps. In early spring, the dimpled naiad sport, as in the time when Oxydalus with untiring wing drave teams of prancing tigers mid the chime. Of all the bells of Phycol, scarcely one Peristeme veils its beauties now, but then, like nascent diamonds sparkling in the sun, or San Juan, Cursinate, or moss in marshy fen. Loud as the blasts of Tubal, loud and strong, sweet as the songs of Sappho, aye, more sweet, long as the spear of Arnon, twice as long. What time he held it at King Pharaoh's feet.
This poem has the curious quality that when you read it, you feel that surely it makes sense. Perhaps another reading will reveal it to you, and then you read it again and find that same head-scratching feeling comes back to you. This is a problem with much modern poetry. It is very hard to be certain that you're not simply being taken for a ride by the poet, sucked in by some practical joker who has actually nothing in mind except tricking readers into thinking there is profound meaning where there is none. The limerick is a form of poetry often featured in nonsense anthologies, probably because it is a playful form. However, very few limericks make no sense. They may involve mild impossibilities, such as a young woman who travels faster than the speed of light, or other more off-color feats, but in actuality, limericks are seldom nonsensical. One limerick that, in its own way, is pure nonsense is the following gem by W.S. Gilbert of Gilbert and Sullivan.
There was an old man of St. Bees who was stung in the arm by a wasp. When asked, does it hurt, he replied, no, it doesn't. I'm so glad it wasn't a hornet.
Why do I call this nonsense? Well, if it were a prose sentence, nothing about it would attract much attention except perhaps the name of the town. The nonsense is certainly not in the content, but in the way it utterly violates every standard set up for the limerick form. It doesn't rhyme, its meter is a little bumpy, and it has absolutely nothing funny in it, which is what makes it funny. And that makes it qualify as nonsense. Is nonsense always funny? Up until the 20th century, it certainly seemed that way. In fact, nonsense and humor have traditionally been so closely allied that anthologies of nonsense seem to be composed largely of humorous passages of any sort whatsoever, irrespective of how sensible they are. But nonsense and humor took widely divergent paths in the early 20th century. Perhaps the greatest nonsense writer who ever lived was Gertrude Stein, although she is seldom mentioned in this connection. Entire collections of nonsense have been published without featuring a single piece of her work. Her most audacious piece in this genre is a volume of nearly 400 pages modestly titled How to Write. Here is a sample taken from the chapter called Arthur a Grammar. Arthur a Grammar. Questionnaire in question. What is a question? 20 questions. A grammar is an astrakhan coat in black and other colors. It is an obliging management of their requesting an indulgence, made mainly if as if in predicament, as in occasion, made plainly as if in serviceable. Does it shine? A question and answer. How do you like it? Grammar can be contained on account of their providing meddling in a ground of allowing with or without, meant because which made coupled became blanketed with a candidly increased, just as if in predicting example of which without, meant and coupled inclined as much without meant to be thought as if it were as ably rested, too, considerable as it counted heavily in part. What is grammar when they make it round and round as they are called? Did they guess whether they wished? A politely, definitely detailed blame of
when they go.
What is a grammar ordinarily? A grammar is question and answer, answer undoubtful, however, how and about. What is Arthur a grammar? Arthur is a grammar. Arthur a grammar. What can there be in a difficulty? Seriously, in grammar. Thinking that a little baby can sigh, that is so much. Saying can say, only he is dead, that he is interested in what is said. That is another inconsequence. Better and flutter must and man can beam. Now think of seams. Embroidery consists in remembering that it is but what she meant. There is an instance of grammar. Suppose embroidery is two and two. There can be reflected that it is as if it were having read about. This is an instance of having settled it. Grammar uses 20 in a predicament, include hyacinths and mosses, which grow in abundance. Grammar. In picking hyacinths quickly, they suit admirably. This makes grammar a preparation. Grammar unites parts and praises in just this way. Grammar untiringly. Grammar, perhaps grammar.
It is quite perplexing. It is simply an absurd... It's simply an absurd string of non sequiturs, often totally lacking grammar, meandering randomly from topic to topic. It is frustrating because there is nothing to grab onto. It is like trying to climb a mountain made of sand. Stein's experiment in absurdity parallel the Dadaist and Surrealist movements of roughly the same period, and they mark the trend away from exuberant and laughable nonsense toward troubling and later macabre nonsense. However, her work still has a freshness and silliness that makes it amusing and light rather than disturbing and heavy. As we move further into the 20th century, we encounter the philosophy of existentialism and the master expositor of existential malaise, Irish-born playwright Samuel Beckett. In Beckett's most famous play, Waiting for Godot, written in the early 1950s, the pathetic character, ironically called Lucky, has exactly one speech coming in about the middle of the play. He has been being taunted by the other characters with cries of, "Think, pig!" and with sharp tugs on the rope around his neck by which they are holding him. Eventually, he is driven beyond the breaking point, and out pours an incoherent, wild, tormented piece of absolute confusion, resembling regurgitated academic coursework, crossed with stock phrases and garbled, memorized lists of one sort or another. Here, then, is Lucky's famous speech.
Your own existence is uttered forth in the public works of Puncher and Watman of a personal god, qua 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 qua, with a white beard, qua 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 qua, outside time, without extension, who from the heights of divine apathia, divine athambia, divine aphasia, loves us dearly with some exceptions for reasons unknown, but time will tell, and suffers like the divine Miranda, with those who for reasons unknown, but time will tell, are plunged in torment, plunged in fire, whose fire flames, if that continues, and who can, it will fire the firmament, that is to say, blast hell to heaven, so blue still, and calm, so calm, with a calm, which even though intermittent is better than nothing, but not so fast, considering what is more, that, as a result of the labors left unfinished, crowned by the Academy of Anthropometry, in Essien Posse of Testu and Cunard, it is established beyond all doubt, all other doubt, that which clings to the labors of men, that as a result of the labors unfinished of Testu and Cunard, it is established as hereinafter, but not so fast, the reason unknown, that as a result of the public works of Puncher and Watman, it is established beyond all doubt, and views of the labors of Fartov and Belcher left unfinished for reasons unknown of Testu and Cunard left unfinished, it is established what many deny, that man in Posse and Testu and Cunard, that man in Essie, that man in short, that man in brief, in spite of the strides of alimentation and defecation, wastes and pines, and concurrently simultaneously, what is more for reasons unknown, in spite of the strides of physical cultural practice of sports, such as tennis, football, running, cycling, gliding, conating, camaging, skating, tennis of all kinds, dying, flying, sports of all sorts, autumn, summer, winter tennis of all kinds, hockey, of all sorts, penicillin, and succedanea, in a word, I resume, flying, gliding, golf over nine, 18 holes, tennis of all sorts, in a word, for reasons unknown, in feckum, peckum, fulum, clapum, namely, concurrently, simultaneously, what is more for reasons unknown, but time will tell, fades away, I resume, fulum, clapum, in a word, the dead loss, per head, since the death of Bishop Berkeley, being to the tune of 1 inch, 4 ounce per head, approximately, by a margin more and less, to the nearest decimal, good measure, round, figures, stark naked in the stocking feet, in Connemara, in a word, for reasons unknown, no matter what matter the facts are there, considering, what is more, much more grave, that in the light of the labor's lost, a Steinweg and Peterman appears, but is more, much more grave, than in the light of the light of the labor's lost, a Steinweg and Peterman, that in the plains and the mountains, by the seas, by the rivers, running water, running fire in the air, is the same, and then the earth, namely the air, and then the earth, and the great cold, the great dark, the air, the earth, abode of stones, and the great cold, alas, alas, in the year of their Lord, 600 and something, the air, the earth, the sea, the earth, abode of stones, and the great deeps, the great cold on sea, on land, and in the air, I resume. For reasons unknown in spite of the tennis, the facts are there, the time will tell, I resume, alas, alas, on, short and fine, on a boat of stones, who could doubt it, I resume, not so fast, I resume the skull, fading, and concurrent, simultaneously, what is more, for reasons unknown, in spite of the tennis, on the beard, the flames, the tears, the stones, so blue, so calm, alas, alas, on the skull, in Camara, in spite of the tennis, the labor's abandoned, left unfinished, graver still, a boat of stones, in a word, I resume, alas, alas, on the
Around the same time as Beckett was writing this play, or perhaps a few years earlier, the Welsh poet Dylan Thomas, intoxicated with the sounds of the English language, was creating poems that are remarkably opaque. Considering the opening two consider, if you will, the opening two stanzas, there are five altogether, of his poem, How Soon the Servant's Son.
How soon the servant's son, Sir Morrow Mark, can time unriddle and the cupboard stone fog has a bone he'll trumpet into meat on shelf that all my gristles have a gown and the naked egg stand straight. Sir Morrow, at his sponge, the wound recalls the nurse of giants by the cut sea basin, fog by his spring, soaks up the sowing tides, tells you and you, my masters, as his strange man borrows, blows through foods.
What? Poems like this made me want to cry out that this emperor has no clothes. As far as I can discern, close to no meaning can be pulled from these lines. But how can I be sure? I cannot. All I can say is that it would very probably take a great effort to decode these lines, and one that I suspect very, very few people would be willing to make. Or take. Make? Take. It is perhaps not so well known that the American singer Bob Dylan, whose name is inspired by that of Dylan Thomas, is also the author of Inspired Nonsense. Some of his nonsense, written during the 1960s, was collected and published in a book called Tarantula. Its tone is often bitter, and it exudes the confused mood of those difficult years. Most of the pieces in the book consist of an outburst of free associations, followed by a letter from some strangely named personage or other. The following sample is called Unbusting the Sound Barrier.
The Neon Dobros F-hole twang and climax from disappointing lyrics of Upstreet Outlaw Mattress while pawing visiting trophies and prop-up drifter with the bag on head in bed next of kin to the naked shade, a tattletale heart and wolf of silver drizzle inevitably threatening a womb with the opening of rusty puddle, bottomless, a rude awakening and gone frozen with dreams of birthday fog. In a box spring of sadly, without candle sitting and depending on a blemished guide, you do not feel so gross, important success, her nostrils whimper. The elder fables and slain kings and inhale manners of furious proportion exhale them against a glassy mud. To dread misery of watery bandwagons grotesque and vomiting into the flowers of additional help. To future treason and telling horrid stories of yesterday's influence. May these voices join with agony in the bells and melt their thousand sonnets now. While the mothballed woman white so sweet shrinks on her radiator far away and watches in with her telescope, you will sit sick with coldness and in an unenchanted closet being relieved only by your dark Jamaican friend. You will draw a mouth on the light bulb so it can laugh more freely. Forget about where you're bound. You're bound for a 3-octave fantastic hexagram. You'll see it, don't worry. You are not bound to pick wildwood flowers. Like I said, you're bound for a 3-octave titanic tantagram. Your little squirrel, Petey the Wheat Straw.
Dylan is not the only popular singer of the 60s to have had a literary bent. John Lennon, when he was in his early 20s, reveled in the nonsensical and published 2 short books called In His Own Right and A Spaniard in the Works. They are still available, bound together in a single paperback volume. The books contain mostly nonsense poetry, although there are several prose selections. 2 of Lennon's poems will serve to illustrate his idiosyncratic style.
I sat belonely. I sat belonely down a tree, humbled, fat, and small. A little lady sing to me, I couldn't see at all. I'm looking up and at the sky to find such wondrous voice. Puzzly puzzle, I wonder why, I hear but have no choice. Speak up, come forth, you revel me, I potty menthol shout. I know you hitty by this tree, but she still, she won't come out. Such softly singing lulled me sleep, an hour or 2 or so. I wakeny slow and took a peep, and still no lady show. Then sooty on a little twig, I thought I see a sight, a tiny little tiny pig, that sing with all his might. I thought you were a lady, I giggle, well I may. To my surprise the lady got up and flew away.
The faulty bag nose.
Softly, softly treads the mongrel, thinner thorn behaviour street. Wog canteel worth be as bin, can we? So all complete with our faulty bag nose. The mongrel pilgrims far away, Rilla George to the world. Sam fells on the waysock side, and Sam Ferb on a girl.
With all her faulty bag nose.
Our mongrel speak to knife at 8, he tell us what to do, and bless us cotton sods again, om nipple to our Jew, with all their faulty bag nose. Bless our girlish ram feed, me cursed cafe name, and bless thee loafy eating with he golden teeth aflame, give us our faulty bag nose. Good mongrel blaith our meat holes, woof bebble more so green the wheel, stagaboon undy some grape load to get a little feel of my own faulty bag nose. It's not our faulty bag nose now, fool lost and dirty hand. Why to all the treble mongrel speak, we might as well be banned, including your faulty bag nose. Give us this be our daily tit, good mongrel, on you travelled, a goat of many coloureds, wibbeneth all beneath unravelled, and not so much of your faulty bag nose.
Well.
Well. The first of these is transparent and charming, while the second is somewhat baffling and disturbing. What in the world is a bag nose? No clear image comes through. And why are all these bag noses faulty? And does faulty have its normal meaning here? Hard to tell. Hard to tell. The idea of normal meanings is turned on its head in a recent book of poetry by William Benton called Just That, Normal Meanings. One section of the book is titled Normal Meanings. Here's an extract from it.
Escape is escape, was once more, continues, vineyards as dusky. He watches it wrinkle into a school bell. It isn't music sometimes. Unhappy. Leaves practically falling off and into the air. Hills, river, sunset ice cream, cone. The buildings, things build up. It must be so many normal meanings. The downstairs lights,
probably, I doubt, these and other stories, the loveliness of houses. Clarissa is the name of the bug I just sent somewhere. The falseness it abjures has seemed in statements we are losing, it's hard to say. A note of privilege which turns up here in their appearances. I drink! The cobweb is becoming a strand, the lamplight its black heart, blessed. A nice...
Elaine.
By the beer.
Some may find the amorphousness of this type of poetry amusing or engaging. Others may find it tiresome, confusing. I personally find it... I personally find it provocative for a while, but then I begin to lose interest. I have somewhat greater interest in the writings of the little-known American rhetorician Y. Serm Clack... Coxia.
Y. Serm Clackcoxia,
who in the past 25 years or so has sporadically penned various pieces of nonsense poetry and prose. Clackcoxia's Y. Serm Clackcoxia prose is marked by a certain degree of vehemence and fire, although it is sometimes a little hard to figure out exactly what he is ranting and raving about. Here follows one of his most lyrical tracks entitled The Illusions of Alacrity.
For millennia, it has been less than appreciated how futile are the efforts of those who seek to sow sobriety in the furrows of trivia. To those of us who have striven to clarify what has been left unclear, it has proven a loss. To others who, whilst valiantly straddling the fine line that divides arid piquancy from acrid pungency, have struggled to set right the many undeeds and unsaids of yore, life has shown itself as a beast of many colors. A mountain of many flags, a hole of many anchors. Who, in fact, were the outcasts of episode, if not the champions of clarity? Where, indeed, were the witnesses to litany when their fortress of fecundity was a being stormed by the Ovaltine monster, that incubus of frozen Cheerios and swollen bananas? And dare one wonder, with the bassoon of lunacy so shrilly betoning the ruined fiddles of flatulism, how it is that doublethink, narcolepsy, and poserism are unthreading themselves across our land like tall, statuesque, half-uneaten, yet virtuous whippoorwills? Can it be that a cornflake catechism has beguiled us into an unsworn acceptance of never-takeism? What sort of intimates are they that would uncouch a mule-bound lout and churlishly swirl his burly figure, unfurl and twirl his curly figure, hurl his whirly figure into the circulating vaults of hysteresis. With a drop of sweat unroasting his feverish brow, we decry his fate. With the patience of a juggernaut and the telemachy of a dozen opossums, we lament his disparity. And summoning all the powers that be, we unbow the jelly of our broken dreams, dashing it with the full fury of a Pleistocene hurdy-gurdy against a lubrified and bulbous nexus of that which, having doomed the dinosaur, seeks the engulfing of all that moves. Thus we act, and perhaps action itself is the Anatole's curlicue of our era. It is high time to recognize that action, and action alone will be the agent that transmutes the flowery barrier of unutterability into an arbitrary but sacred iota of purposefulness, which cannot help but penetrate into an otherwise nameless and universally spaghettified lack of meaning, which smears and beclouds the crab-lit hopes of half-beings begging for deliverance from their own private yet strangely tuberculine maelstroms that begat and begotten wherefrom a howling sea of ribosomal plagiarism.
This is deliberate nonsense, of course, to be contrasted with the non-deliberate nonsense of, say, Dylan Thomas, or the nonsense to be found in crackpot letters written to scientists.
Why, sir, clackcoxia?
Crack, 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 crack.
Crackpot ideas seem to be an inevitable ingredient of any society in which serious scientific research is carried out. There is no way to plug all the cracks, so to speak. There is no way to ensure that only high-quality science will be done. Fortunately, most journals do not publish absolute nonsense or gobbledygook. It is filtered out at a very early stage. However, one journal I have come across, whose pages are filled with other... However, one journal I have come across, whose pages are filled with utter nonsense, meant seriously, is called Art Language. To show what I mean, here are two short excerpts from the May 1975 issue. The first one is taken from the beginning of an article called Community Work. It seems from the table of contents to have been written by three people collectively. The second one is taken from an article called Vulgar and Popular Opinions, and seems to have a single author.
Dionysus gets a job. Regarding language has got a hold on U.S. It's a Worfian conspiracy.
This is a hopeless man-kay ontological alienation, which is still dealing with ideas about discovery as a function of a metaphysics of categories. Only for researchers is the failure of a modal logic industry to catch my experience, the birth of tragedy. Going on in A to L indexed somehow is a thing in and for dynamically itself, that we never catch up with the nature-culture logic has little to do with the actualizing sets of the frozen dialogue, and it's not just a ledger. Our problems with set theoretical axiomata are embedded into our praxis as more than just historical antecedents, more than nomological permissibility, more than selective filtration. We still don't recognize ourselves as very fundamental history producers. The possibility of a defense of a set, as with a decision, is an index margin of a prima facie ersatz principle for action. There is no workable distinction between oratio recta and oratio oblique. All we are left with is a deontic drang. Think of that as a chain strength possibility of what eventually comes out as a product. Epistemic additions on the product, if it is not a Frankfurtish packaging it all in. A slogan might be thought of as a freeform comprised of multiple structural features occurring in a partially given or negotiable unit relative to others. That is, the slogan is a unit in one sense or another, and going on ideologically, perhaps a slogan is a unitary filler for and of that stretch of surf less than surf, which is in a B times S position. But there is the critical issue of that filler as a reified function of the pusillanimous tittle-tattle of authenticity in its ellipticality as a das Volkholism, e.g. the Fox material. Passim falls into that trap in dealing with the cultural space as a wantonly dialectic region approaching with solution to the negation of essence of Homo sapiens, art, or what?
I am tempted to quote further to show how the wild quality of the AL prose just goes on and on. But life is short. It is hard for this human being to believe that these paragraphs were meant to communicate something to anybody, but the journal appears regularly, at least it used to, and can be found on the shelves of reputable art libraries. Reputable art libraries. Isn't it time that somebody blew the whistle? The curious thing about art language is that the collective that writes it appears to consist of people who are deeply concerned with issues that hold much interest for me, the nature of reference, the relationship of wholes to parts, the connection of art and reality, the structure of society, the philosophy of set theory, the questionable existence of mathematical concepts, and so on. What is amazing is how such concepts can be so obscured by language that it is hard to make out anything except huge billows of very thick smoke. An American poet whose work explores ground midway between nonsense and sense is Russell Edson. He writes tiny surrealistic vignettes that shed a strange light on life. He often performs strange reversals as of animate and inanimate beings, or humans and animals. His grammar is also oblique, one of his favorite devices being to refer repeatedly to something specific with the indefinite article or a, thus disorienting the reader. A typical sample of Edson's style is the following, drawn from his book, The Clam Theater. Excuse me. When science is in the country. Excuse me. When science is in the country, a cow meows and the moon jumps from limb to limb through the trees like a silver ape. The cow bow-wows to hear all voice of itself. The grass sinks back into the earth looking for its mother. A farmer dreamed he harvested the universe and had a barn full of stars with a herd of clouds fenced in the pasture. The farmer awoke to something screaming in the kitchen, which he identified as the farmerette. Oh my, cried the farmer, what is to become of what became?
It's a good piece of bread and a bad farmer man,
she cried. Oh, the devil take the monotony of the field, he screamed.
Which grows your eating thing,
she wailed. Which is the hell with me too, he screamed.
And the farmerette,
she screamed. And the farmerette, he howled. A scientist looked through his magnifying glass in the neighborhood. This eerie tale leaves one with a host of unresolved images. That, of course, is Edson's intent. And in this regard, Edson's work is quite typical. Most of the nonsense of the 20th century, it seems, has this deliberately upsetting quality to it, reflecting a deep malaise. It is utterly different from the nonsense of the preceding centuries, similar trends exist in the other arts, particularly in music, where classical composers have lost 99% of their audience by their experimentation with randomness and cacophony. However, the spirit of experimentation has also crept into rock music, where electronic sounds and unusual rhythms are occasionally heard. The surrealistic, nonsensical spirit also pervades the names of popular groups such as Iron Butterfly, Tangerine Dream, Led Zeppelin, Joy of Cooking, Human Sexual Response, Captain Beefheart, Brand X, Jefferson Starship, Average White Band, and so on. Perhaps one of the virtues of nonsense is that it opens our minds to new possibilities. The mere juxtaposition of a few arbitrary words can send the mind soaring into imaginary worlds. It is as if sense were too mundane and we need a breather once in a while. Perhaps sense is also too confining. Nonsense stresses the incomprehensible face of the universe, while sense stresses the comprehensible. Clearly, both are important.
Zen
teachings have striven to impart the path to quote-unquote enlightenment. Although I don't believe that such a mystical state exists, I am fascinated by the paths that are offered. Zen itself is perhaps the archetypal source of utter nonsense. It seems fitting to close this column with two Zen
koans
taken from the
Mumonkan,
or the Gateless Gate, a set of koans commented upon by the Zen master
Mumon
in the 13th century.
Joshu examining a monk in meditation.
Joshu went to a place where a monk had retired to meditate and asked him, "What is what?" The monk raised his fist. Joshu replied, "Ships cannot remain where the water is too shallow," and he left. A few days later, Joshu went again to visit the monk and asked the same question. The monk answered the same way. Joshu said, "Well given, well taken, well killed, well saved," and he bowed to the monk.
Mumon's comment.
Mumon.
The raised fist was the same both times. Why is it Joshu did not admit the first and approve the second one? Where is the fault? Whoever answers this knows that Joshu's tongue has no bone, so he can use it freely. Yet perhaps Joshu is wrong, or through the monk, he may have discovered his mistake. If anyone thinks that the one's insight exceeds the other's, he has no eyes.
Mumon's poem.
The light of the eyes is as a comet, and Zen's activity is as lightning. The sword that kills the man is the sword that saves the man. Learning is not the path. Nansen said, Nansen said, mind is not Buddha. Learning is not the path.
Mumon's comment.
Nansen was getting old and forgot to be ashamed. He spoke out with bad breath and exposed the scandal of his own home. However, there are few who appreciate his kindness.
Mumon's poem.
When the sky is clear, the sun appears. When the earth is parched, rain will fall. He opened his heart fully and spoke out. But it was useless to talk to pigs and fish.
Postscriptum by the author. Douglas Hofstadter. I was quite aware that I had omitted some nonsense specialists such as James Joyce when I wrote this column, but there were reasons. I haven't studied Joyce, and I feel there is a lot of complexity there. To call Joyce's strange concoctions nonsense is to miss the mark. Several people wrote in disappointed that I did not include anything by Walt Kelly, the creator of Pogo. I have to agree that Kelly was a unique writer of ingenious and charming nonsense. In fact, I was lucky enough to grow up knowing the Pogo Songbook, a record of some of Kelly's most inspired silly songs, some of them belted out by
James Joyce,
the old man Kelly himself. One that gets across the flavor very well is this one.
Twirl, twirl. Twirl, twirl, twinkle between. The tweezers are twist in the twittering twain. Twirl, twirl, entwiningly twirl. Twixt twice 20 twigs, passing platitudes plain. Plunder the plover and rover besides round. Ride all the rungs on the brassily bound. Billy, swirl, swirl, swingingly swirl. Sweep along, swoop along, sweetly your swain.
Well, the poem is catchy and rhythmic, and I cannot read it without hearing the song in my head. Few people know that Kelly was a good composer of catchy melodies, but his songs, unlike his lyrics, follow very ordinary, sensible rules of musical syntax. Two other pieces of inspired nonsense that I have run across since writing this column are Tom Phillips'
A Humament
and Luigi Serafini's Codex Serafinianus.
The former, subtitled a treated Victorian novel, was made by a sort of literary cannibalism from another novel entitled
A Human Document,
itself written by a little-known Victorian novelist named
James Joyce.
William Hurrell Malick.
Sausage.
Phillips treated this novel by colorfully and imaginatively overpainting nearly all its pages, blotting out most of the text, leaving only a select few words or letters to poke their heads through and make cameo appearances. Now, and then, this creation or revelation of hidden messages in someone else's text yields some very strange effects. The first page of
A Humament
reads this way. I've slightly modified the two-dimensional placement of the words on the page.
The following sing I a book of art, of mind and art, that which he hid, reveal I.
Codex Serafinianus is a much more elaborate work. In fact, it is highly idiosyncratic. A magnum opus by an Italian architect indulging his sense of fancy to the hilt. It consists of two volumes and a completely invented language, including the numbering system, which is itself rather esoteric, penned entirely by the author, accompanied by thousands of beautifully drawn color pictures of the most fantastic scenes, machines, beasts, feasts, and so on. It purports to be a vast encyclopedia of a hypothetical land somewhat like the Earth, with many creatures resembling people to various degrees, but many creatures of unheard of bizarreness promenading throughout the countryside. Serafini has sections on physics, chemistry, mineralogy, including many drawings of elaborate gems, geography, botany, zoology, sociology, linguistics, technology, architecture, sports.
Serafini.
Of all sorts, clothing, and so on. The pictures have their own internal logic, but to our eyes, they are filled with utter non sequiturs. Typical example depicts an automobile chassis covered with some huge piece of what appears to be melting gum in the shape of a small mountain range. And all over the gum are small insects, and the wheels of the car appear to have melted as well. The explanation is all there for anyone to read, if only they can decipher Serafinian. Unfortunately, no one knows that language. Fortunately, on another page, there is one picture of a scholar standing by what appears to be a Rosetta Stone. Unfortunately, the only language on it besides Serafinian itself is an unknown kind of hieroglyphics. Thus, the stone is of no help unless you already know
Serafinian.
Oh well. Many of the pictures are grotesque and disturbing, but others are extremely beautiful and visionary. The inventiveness that it took to come up with all these conceptions of a hypothetical land is staggering.
Serafinian.
Some people with whom I have shared this book find it frightening or disturbing in some way. It seems to them to glorify entropy, chaos, and incomprehensibility. There is very, very little to fasten onto. Everything shifts, shimmers, slips.
Yet the book has a kind of unearthly beauty and logic to it, qualities pleasing to a different class of people, people who are more at ease with freewheeling fantasy and, in some sense, craziness. I see some parallels between musical composition and this kind of invention. Both are abstract, both create a mood, both rely largely on style to convey content. Music is,
in a way,
a kind of nonsense that nobody really understands. It captivates nearly every human being who can hear, and yet, for all that, we still know amazingly little about how music works its wonders. But if music is a kind of
auditory nonsense
that does not prevent there from arising even more extreme brands of auditory super nonsense, the works of Karlheinz Stockhausen, Peter Maxwell Davies,
Luciano Berio,
and John Cage will provide a wonderful introduction to that genre in case some reader does not know what I am talking about. Especially if you like the banging of garbage can lids or the sound of gangland murders, their musical offerings are sure to be right up your alley. The purpose of this column was to emphasize the very fine line that separates the meaningful from the meaningless. It is a boundary line that has a great deal to do with the nature of human intelligence, because the question of how meaning emerges out of meaningless constituents, when combined in certain patterned ways, is still a perplexing one.
Computers
are good at producing very simple passages that, to us, seem to have meaning.
And they are excellent at producing passages that are utterly devoid of meaning.
Computers.
It will be interesting to see if someday a computer can tread the line and produce an artistic exploration of meaning by providing provocative nonsense in the same way as these human explorers of the territory have done.